The Shortcode Podcast is a proud member of the MedEd Media Network. Inspiration, information, and guidance on your journey to medical school and beyond at mededmedia.com.
Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcode Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues, and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast, a production of the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. I'm Dave Atler. Oh, hang on a minute. What do we have here? Why, it's graduating senior John Pienta.
Yep.
It's third year, Casey McCleary.
Hey.
It's MSTP student, Aline Sanduk.
Oh, hello.
It's third year, Nathan Miller.
It's good to be back.
Yeah. I'm saying which year you are because we got a request from a listener who was like, I really want to know like where people are in their, so I'm going to try to remember to do that. Jonas Salk's Nipples, what a great group of students to have in the...
Excuse me?
What is this?
I think that was Dave's version of Great Caesar's Ghost.
Yes.
Janky.
What a great group of people to have in the studio today.
Little known fact, Jonas Salk did have world-class nipples.
What?
We might need to workshop that a bit.
Guys, let's get right to this, though. Med students and undergrad pre-med students, put away the nicotine gum, the Adderall, any other drugs you might unwisely be using to enhance your mental capacity while studying. Instead, choose Marmite. You guys ever heard of Marmite?
Oh, I am not familiar with Marmite.
No.
So it's a product of the UK and New Zealand. Each of their versions has the same trade name, slightly different though. It's popular enough around the world that there are similar products called Vegemite in Australia, Senovis in Switzerland, which sounds like an ED drug, Vitam R in Germany. It's basically a super salty, dark brown, sticky yeast paste that you put on toast in the morning.
It's basically more bread. Like, I don't know why you put it on bread.
It's
like bad, terrible, squishy bread paste.
It's super yeast. It's super paste. Super bread, I guess you would maybe call it.
Okay.
I didn't realize this. It's actually named after the container it once came in, which is a Marmite, I guess you might say in French.
Yeah, I couldn't tell by your earlier pronunciation.
Marmite. Yeah.
Ouch.
Sorry. Well,
doesn't speak French. It's okay. Don't feel bad.
Yeah, Marmite.
That was much better.
Researchers at York University in the UK say they discovered a link between eating Marmite and brain activity. The link is an increase in GABA, which, for those of you who don't know, like me, inhibits the excitation of neural activity. Does that sound about right?
So why
I thought this was a stimulant that we were talking about.
You would think that, but apparently it focuses your concentration because there's not all these external
twitching,
things like happening. You're just like focused. Anyway.
Good for anxious people, maybe.
Oh,
yeah.
I could see that.
Well, the authors of the study suspect that it's due to the high B12 concentration, which is 116 times more than is present in peanut butter. So,
dear Lord.
There you go.
Woof. Won't you just pee it out, though? Like, B is water soluble.
Mm.
So any excess.
Yeah.
What are you?
Get out of here with your logic.
Student.
Yeah. God, talk about raining on the parade.
I just don't want to eat it.
Well, critics of the study point out that there are lots of differences between Marmite and peanut butter, which they used as a control in the experiment. So, Marmite has lots more salt. It has six times the B6, twice as much glutamate. But, you know, I think that you guys probably need a leg up. And that's why we're going to try Marmite today.
Are we going to smear it on our faces?
We are not. No. It looks very similar to the black mask.
Dave's actually prepared an IV for us.
Looks very similar to the black mask, which we tried a couple of shows ago. But no, John, unless you want to, I'm not going to stop you.
Can we smear it other places?
Nathan, reach behind you. In the box there. Yeah, there you go.
He hit it so we couldn't see it and
I
run.
I knew that this box on its side was very suspicious.
Why don't you just drag the whole, drag the tray out into the middle of the table so that people can...
Dave, you're a monster.
I don't like either of these things.
Partake. You don't like peanut butter?
I don't.
Who the hell doesn't like peanut butter?
Me. It's almost, I'm tempted to just tell people that I have an allergy, you know, because every time I say I don't like peanut butter, they're like...
Yeah, I know. People who don't like things that everybody else likes, they get shit on. People who don't like chocolate.
He's all like defensive.
Oh, yeah. People who don't like chocolate are like horrible creatures.
It's true. This is good. It's got fully hydrogenated vegetable oil.
Yeah, we don't want any. Is that?
Don't half ass your hydrogenated.
No, it's
that's partially hydrogenated is bad. Fully hydrogenated is apparently okay.
Yeah,
the first two ingredients are what I use to grow bacteria: yeast extract and salt.
That's of Marmite. Sweet.
Also, it's probiotic. They said that.
Was salt supposed to be a selling point for this? I think we're getting enough salt as it is in our diets.
Well, I don't know about. I don't know. Maybe the British had a salt problem.
Oh,
so okay. So this became really popular apparently during World War I. It was included in rations for British soldiers. Oh, so
it won't go bad.
Because no other creature on Earth wants to eat it.
Well, I don't know if you know this or not, but the whole of human history is really about. When it comes to food, is about making things go bad so they can't get any worse.
I think we should try to recreate this study. So,
Dave, how old is this bread?
I just toasted it about an hour ago.
Oh, it's toasted.
Oh, it's toasted.
That makes me feel a little better.
Yeah, yeah.
For those who can't see, it's like standing up on its end, on the ends of the pieces of bread.
It's not laying flat on the pan.
It is toasted, John. That's your piece of bread now.
Here's the sound.
Yes. It's basically white Melba toast.
So this is a Unilever brand, so you could actually spread it on your face.
Yes.
Oh,
it could work.
Yes. So grab a slice of bread. I'm going to think of a number between 1 and 2. This is probably the worst way to pick.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to pick a number between 1 and 2. Okay. Casey.
What?
Casey, pick a number between 1 and 2.
I'm assuming you're picking whole numbers and
1.9.
No, whole number.
Whole numbers and
you
inclusive.
You didn't stipulate that.
I do now.
Dave.
And inclusive
wait,
of 1
don't
and
eat
2.
All the bread. You're going to need
inclusive
it.
Of 1 and 2?
Or 2.
2.
All right, you get to eat Marmite.
Yay.
Aline, pick a number, 1 or 2.
2.
You get to eat Marmite.
Aww.
And you guys get to eat peanut butter.
How is that surprising?
Okay. That was easy enough.
You're going to get to eat Marmite, too. All right.
I know. I want to try the Marmite. I don't want my palate marred by Jif.
I already had Jif this morning, right before coming in, actually.
It looks like really thick motor oil.
Yeah, it looks like... yeah.
It's also a lot... less homogenous than I thought it would be.
I would say
that's two colors.
Like
right
a thick
there.
Machine grease is probably the best description. Yeah.
Oh wait, hey, speaking of machine grease.
Like chain grease.
You want a fun fact for the day? Vaseline actually came from like machine oil that I want to say it was like sailors would put over their wounds because it was like thick and would keep it from bleeding.
Sure, that's what sailors did with it.
And then somebody was like, hey, I should make a thing that people will pay for. And then they refined it, and now we have Vaseline.
That's awesome.
There you go.
Weren't there knives here a second ago? Where did the knives go?
I took a knife, and I've just been brandishing it around.
One for each spread.
There's.
I've been brandishing around the whole
time. Stop brandishing your knives, your Marmite-covered knife. Aline looks distinctly unhappy about this idea.
Oh,
don't be you're from a whole nother country. You should be you should be like excited about the prospect of
we're opening our minds.
Let's document this in real time. So the Marmite has it looks promising at first because it has a caramel style consistency.
Oh,
yeah.
Good description.
Yeah,
I would say.
I want some Marmite.
It just smells like more bread.
Mm.
Can you bring me the trash can, Dave?
Yes. That's ominous.
Uh-oh.
Gum.
Oh.
We thought you had already eaten it and needed to...
I'm taking a bite.
Oh, we'll just leave it here.
Oh, mother of God, that is the saltiest thing I've ever eaten in my life.
So the point...
Oh. It tastes like soy. It tastes like...
Are John and I supposed to be just eating our normal peanut butter here?
Jesus.
Or what are we doing?
I'll be right back.
Yeah, just eat your peanut butter and where are you going?
Get water.
Well, we'll just put the whole show on hold.
Oh my god, that is salty.
So,
the Jif tastes like Jif.
So eat up, because you're going to need this when we take a pop quiz later in the show.
Well, that's why the jar is so small. I put this much, and it tastes awful. Maybe you just don't need that much. God, the British. Yeah, the British are not known for their food, Dave.
No. Yeah.
Let's
that
be
is
honest.
Correct.
No one has ever been like, I need to go to the UK for the food.
Okay, they don't even have their own national cuisine. Indian food is the national cuisine of Britain.
You know,
this
yes,
is not the worst thing I've ever had.
The most popular
I'm so
dish.
Sorry.
It's not great. Holy. I just
see? It's a slow
I just
burn.
Swallowed it, and there's a something that happens when you swallow it.
I never thought I'd say this, but I want some peanut butter to rinse the taste out.
Oh, God in heaven.
So when I eat
this
stuff
had better,
on toast,
I'll tell you what, this had better make me smarter.
It had better be good for you.
Not worth it.
Oh, Dave, you got to take that cognitive test again after eating a bunch of Marmite.
Yeah.
Dave failed the mini mental status exam.
No,
no, no. It was more than the mini mental status.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it was the full deal.
Did you fail like an IQ test?
So I have to, for the listeners, my wife is practicing using this. I can't remember which one it is. It's like
mocha.
Oh, mocha.
Mm.
So she was practicing giving it, and she brought it home. And yeah, I'd had a beer.
Lightweight.
But she was just like, okay, so first of all, the questions that I did not get right were, to me, completely ridiculous. And I answered the questions correctly, but it wasn't the question, the answer that they wanted. So I was kind of pissed off by that.
And did you fail the ones that were like, how are these things similar?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the one.
People always get cheesed about those.
Oh my God, I was so angry.
So Marmite actually just tastes like a very salty, but kind of a bland, molasses.
Wouldn't call it bland.
It tastes...
But the saltiness is so strong
that you really can't taste much else.
You really shouldn't use very much at all. I think that's the point.
Yeah. You're supposed to use...
Serving size is a half a teaspoon.
What?
That's still a decent
amount.
And
has 200 milligrams of sodium in it.
Dear God.
Guys, I...
That's not that...
So we're gonna... So we're we've taken in our nutrients, either Marmite or peanut butter, and then later in the show we're gonna have a pop quiz. Meanwhile, we're just gonna give it some time to settle into our systems, give us that B12 goodness.
Mm. Wait, we didn't do a pretest.
I
hey,
do
look. This is science. Science can be anything you want it to be.
I have a listener question. That I've been sitting on for a while because I wanted an MSTP student on hand.
Yay!
Hannah wrote to us at theshortcoats@gmail.com to say some very nice things. Thanks, Hannah. And to ask this question.
I've been working in a neuroscience research lab for the past 8 months and truly enjoy the research aspect of medicine. One of my professors suggested looking into an MD, PhD, or MSTP track. I was hoping you could maybe discuss the topic of the dual degree program, or maybe someone there has some first-hand experience. I'm curious to find out how different it would be compared to a typical MD program on a day-to-day basis.
That's a great question. So let's...
Ooh, ooh.
I
know. Wait, so...
She's actually a great person because she started MSTP having done like a year or two of MD.
Well, let's start. I thought let's start with the typical day-to-day experience. This is a complicated question. I'm not sure we can
There's
get to all of it.
Here, yeah.
But let's start with the typical MD experience, MD student experience.
And just to clarify, are we talking about like in the future career-wise what the difference would be or
no,
how the
schooling
goes? Okay. Mm. Okay.
That's how I took her question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So you begin your medical school as an MD student. You Excuse me. As you begin your MD student journey, you begin in the preclinical phase. So a lot of your time is taken up by things like lectures, small groups, right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, studying your ass off.
Yeah, the MSTP and MD PhD programs are not that much different from like a traditional MD on a day-to-day basis.
In the beginning.
In the beginning, except that like in the middle of med school, you just like cut it in half and then insert a second degree in between. But in the first couple of years, you're going through the same experience as MD students, like pretty faithfully, and maybe some added programming that keeps you connected to other MSTP students and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, because I gather that one of the downsides of an MD PhD program is that you get disconnected from the original class that you came in with because they've moved on and graduated and whatever.
Yeah, we peace yeah. out.
Not only have they graduated, but they will finish residency usually as well before you graduate medical school.
Yeah, yeah. That's very
they
true.
They could be year attending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be
when
really
you're
weird.
When you're
going
through
clinicals.
That
yeah.
actually does happen.
I never thought of that.
Yeah,
weird.
Your former classmates are now your supervisors, and
wow.
it's weird.
So yeah, I mean, if you want to look at it. Basically, if you want to look at it in this way, an MD PhD student does the same things as an MD student and the same things as a graduate student. I don't think in most schools generally at the same time. So like you said, their MD experience gets chopped in half and then inserted in the middle. You get the full graduate, you know, like I'm going to get a PhD degree that you would get mm-hmm. otherwise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's an interesting interpersonal component no one really tells you about, where you have feet in both worlds, but both student populations dislike you for different reasons.
What?
Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah. So I noticed in grad school that a lot of my classmates and, you know, people in the program at one point maybe had considered applying to med school or had aspired and had actually taken the MCAT, and, you know, for whatever reason, which are varied and, you know, diverse, decided to go to grad school.
Wait, I'm confused. We're talking about the people who are not MD PhD students, who are PhD students in the lab with you.
Yeah.
Okay.
So some people sometimes will have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder, which is like, it's not your fault, but it's like dating someone and finding out that they have emotional baggage, which, you know, you are not the cause of, but you are now the recipient of as the person who is in the most trivial way related to other people who have misbehaved.
Right.
Right. So from day one, I learned very quickly to not talk about med school at all, ever. Because best case scenario, people just glaze over in grad school. Worst case scenario, they actually get really annoyed and irritated with you and just don't want to hear about it. They just don't want to know. And so probably only on the first day I mentioned that I was, you know, had already been living here for a while. Oh, why? Well, because I went to, you know, did the first year of med school. But after that, I just purely identify myself as a first year grad student and recognize my place in the grad school hierarchy to avoid, you know, kind of running into these political problems.
Yeah. I'd never heard that before. That's interesting.
And did you say there was the other direction as well from the medical students? I wasn't curious to hear about that.
Okay, so what I noticed pretty soon after I got in, people shamelessly asked me about the financial support, which I thought was like,
we're jealous.
Very off color. Yeah, but I'm worse off than the rest of you because maybe I have less debt, but now I've postponed my income earning years by several years.
Mm, that's true.
So my debt is going to grow at a faster rate than everyone else. I'm in the worst boat. I've postponed my career and I have huge amounts of debt that I can't possibly pay off in a reasonable time frame, you know. But I don't know. I'm a little old fashioned and asked, like, talking about money just makes me chafe. And I just was raised not to, you know, even in a family. But people were like, oh, so do they go back and pay for your first years? I was like, no. And they were like, oh, so are you getting paid now? No. They didn't actually start paying me a stipend until I started grad school.
Right.
There's also a small distinction between MSTPs and MD PhD programs, which I'm not sure if the listener is aware of, but an MSTP is called a medical scientist training program because the funding comes from NIH, which is more secure, as opposed to an MD PhD program, which is the medical school and the grad school, you know, at that institution are sort of covering the costs themselves. So it's a little less secure.
I did not know that.
And I think MSTP usually pays for more stuff, right?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't interview at other MSTPs, but I've heard people say that.
So. Yeah, I was looking into it when I started applying and ultimately decided I didn't want to stay in the same place for like 8 years.
That was a commitment.
Huge deciding factor. And also that if you want to do like clinical research versus bench work and like wet lab research, the latter is much more appropriate, I think, for like an MD PhD, like a combined program, whereas with clinical research, that's not unreasonable. A lot of people do that with like just an MD. Just an MD.
Your quotes. We always collaborate out what you can't do.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, so many schools, or I don't know how many schools have MD PhD programs, but I know that some schools at least offer a way for undergrads to sort of get their feet wet in the MD PhD world. For instance, Iowa has a the SUMR program for pre-med students to take advantage of research or get involved in research over a summer before they're accepted into med school, before they're accepted into MD PhD, their MSTP program, to sort of, you know, experience, you know, science with a big S, and so that's something to look into. And I think there's a list out there somewhere that I can put a link to on our website that you can check out. I'm really glad Iowa's one of them.
Yeah,
that's a good resource.
So we were talking about this before the show, that a lot of these summer programs are like feeders into MSTPs. They recruit from those programs just because it's like a mini interview. They see how you fare in the lab. They see how you fare at the institution. Usually you go and live at the institution where you do the summer program. And so...
Yeah.
I don't know if this is interesting, but I just Googled real quick.
We'll judge you for how interesting this is.
Okay, perfect. Good. As expected.
Yes.
So there's a total number of 118 MD PhD programs in the US, and of those, 45 of them are MSTPs. So funded by NIH. And in total, nationwide, I think this is for MSTP specifically, not all programs, but there's 890 trainees, MSTP trainees in all stages of the programs.
Yeah, that's not a lot.
Yeah, it's very, very small. Yeah.
The other thing as far as the qualifications that one might have to have in terms of, I don't know, temperament, what would you have to say about that?
Research experience is a must.
Sure.
But the reason that you would apply for an MSTP or an MD PhD is because you see caring for patients as part of your future career alongside doing research. So, but you really have to be able to justify why you want to do both, which is challenging for some people. Some people really are interested just in doing research, and patients tend to be, you know, an obstacle.
I always think that going into med school requires a certain amount of resilience, in general, because med school is difficult, and you know, it's not just difficult academically, it's difficult emotionally, it's difficult in many ways that you might not ordinarily expect. Mm-hmm. Research requires maybe a slightly different kind of resilience. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I would agree. It's if you can get used to the fact that you're going to be doing the same thing over and over and over and have it not work despite your best effort at troubleshooting and optimizing, maybe even like getting into a lab, not that this applies to me at all or anything, but coming into a lab, being handed what is essentially a worked out protocol by someone who had left, trying to do it yourself and then not having it work despite doing it almost exactly the same way. This is really tough. And it's not to say that the person who, you know, worked out the protocol didn't do a good job. It's just like we have this expression in the lab called like good lab hands. Like someone has good hands and some people have bad hands. And it could be, you could be following the same instructions on paper, but the difference is like, oh, maybe this guy pipettes like really forcefully and you pipette really gently. It could be that subtle a difference in how you do your experiments that lead to a successful outcome versus
That's something that actually kind of burned me in undergrad on lab research, because I was in a Parkinson's research lab and they were like, okay, time for your first like big project. You can do it on your own. Here's these like cell. It was for immunofluorescent stains that they were trying that would like, it was a different method for staining that was supposed to be easier. So I like did it all and I did all this stuff and I like tried so hard to do it all right. And then I look under the microscope and there's nothing, you know? And the grad students are like, that's okay. Like half of us didn't even expect this to work because blah, blah reasons, you know? But I still like, I felt like such a failure. And I felt like it was hard to even go back to the lab after that because I was like, I'm just disappointed.
And they're trying to weed you out.
I don't know. I don't know. But it was like,
it was your rite of passage.
Give her the fluorescent thing.
It was very intimidating, like to not have that work and then like try to go back. It was just that was a big turning point for me, being like, I guess I'm not doing this MD PhD thing because I can't handle this all the time.
I think it's a matter of perspective. So I like that. Like, I don't mind it. I like a challenge. I like that type of intellectual challenge where I have to break down each step and understand exactly what's happening at each step. It's very painstaking, but no one's life is on the line. That's the difference for me, which really takes the pressure off. Whereas in med school, the feedback is immediate, right? You do a good job, patient lives. You do a bad job, patient dies. kind of. But it's a little more binary. Wow. It's a little more binary. But the point is, the feedback is so quick, right? You get your answer kind of almost on the spot. You do a thing, you intervene in some way, and if you did a good job, you'll find out very quickly. Research takes maybe a little...
Yeah, or at least in the scale of days to weeks rather than years the lab work.
Sure.
So, I don't know.
All right. Well, I hope we've helped Hannah.
And if Hannah has more questions, please feel free to reach back out and, you know, don't hesitate to drop us a line if we can answer any other questions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Good news. The FDA has approved 23andMe to test for actual genetic diseases. Little backstory. 23andMe was prohibited, I think, in 2013. Maybe it was later, 2015. I can't remember. Anyway, they were prohibited for a time for offering tests to consumers for genetic diseases because there was no proof that this was something that they were capable of doing with any consistency, with any reliability. But the FDA has rescinded that. Now you can get tested at home for things like alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency or factor 11 deficiency or Gaucher's disease type 1 or early onset primary dystonia, some blood disorder, celiac disease, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's.
Oh, really? God. Oh, I don't like those last two.
Exciting.
I don't like those last two. Those are like risk factor genes. Yeah. The other ones are just like you have the gene,
yes,
you got the thing.
Yes or no type questions.
Yeah, like you either have alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency or you don't.
I was going to say, for a couple of those, they should come to clinical attention pretty early on in life.
You would know.
Yeah.
But maybe, Gauchers. I don't know.
Maybe it's a cheaper option, you know, if a doctor's like, I think you have this, but it's going to cost like thousands of dollars to do it through insurance, you should go buy this test or something, maybe.
Maybe. Well, the FDA says it's satisfied that the tests are now backed up by evidence and that they'll be accurate and reliable. The company won't be required to submit any additional tests for approval that they add in the future, as long as they use the FDA's new special controls criteria, which sets out the agency's requirements for assuring tests work as intended, which I think is interesting. So now they can just start adding.
And that's perfect, because that's what they were aiming for. That 23andMe wanted to be greenlit to have all future testing be, you know, some rigorously defined as to how it would be approved.
Yeah. Is this a good thing?
What are those standards?
I mean, are you looking forward to patients coming into your practice and saying, hey, I tested positive for Alzheimer's or whatever? I mean,
no.
Well, I mean, clearly
not. Some of them, just not for the risk factor ones. I feel like I don't like those because patients, it's good to have a little bit of like maybe guidance or comfort or like be already connected with the system if you find out you're like probably gonna have Parkinson's. But I don't know, maybe some people would rather know earlier.
Well, a lot of these things too tend to be familial, right? So like the known and I would say validated Alzheimer's risk ones are modified versions of lipoproteins.
Yeah.
Was it E1 and E4 or E2?
E2 and 4.
Yeah.
I don't remember something like that.
Yeah, that's step one type stuff right there. Just went right out.
Already gone.
Yep. Let's not talk about that. Let's not talk about that.
Don't say that word.
Right out the door. And those are pretty well validated as being remarkably demonstrative of risk, right? So like but it doesn't necessarily mean anything about, you know, the causative mechanism. So it doesn't, you know, so the ones that you mentioned, like Gaucher's disease and things like that, are
it's not called Gaucher.
I call it Gaucher. I've never heard it said. I just read it a lot.
I knew I couldn't get through an episode.
I've never said that before. It's all over first.
It's the French.
There's
it's always the French. Gaucher. Just blame them.
There's a lot of stuff that I can't pronounce right because I've just read it like in textbooks.
It's right. It's rare enough
lot.
You'll probably never see it in real life, but you know, for the test.
What were you saying, Joe?
Well, I do that all the time because I read a lot, so I get corrected on them, and then I say them like a pompous ass.
The first time it ever happened.
I'm afraid you have Gaucher's.
Well, that's how people say absence seizures.
Right.
Oh. Absence.
Oh, God.
It looks like absence. It's not fair.
So, again, it's all part of the indoctrination process. They just have to pick you out on, you know, call you out on something to assert their authority. Yeah.
I do believe.
not jaded or anything.
No.
But those, you know, it's like what Casey said. It's exactly what Casey said. It's sort of like you have this gene, you have this disease. And then we kind of knew that.
Yeah.
But as we move more towards these sort of correlative things, you know, where having this single letter change in your genetic code at one location increases your risk of having X, Y, or Z by 2% based on some massive population database, that's probably going to cause more anxiety than it's worth.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because we have no reason to believe that 2% or whatever isn't just an artifact.
Mm-hmm.
And that's completely neglecting all sorts of higher order effects. Like, you know, maybe that 2% is really 40% higher, but only in people who smoke.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
But some people who have that genetic locus, it's 10% lower if they're not smoking.
Yeah.
And so if you know, so and that's, there's all sorts of things that we are starting to learn are really an impact. There was a study to look at using vitamins to prevent or delay macular degeneration. Mm-hmm. And it showed promising results. And it's like one of the first, if not maybe the only study that's really shown like the use of vitamins as a therapeutic tool for disease prevention. It turned out that the formula that they used had a reasonable amount of vitamin A in it. And as they were tracking it, the people who received the vitamin A and were also smokers ended up having a demonstrably higher risk of lung cancer.
Oh, golly.
So they actually stopped the study. They reformulated the vitamin. They did a lot. Like, there was a lot. So I don't even know that you can get the original formulation anymore. It's called AREDS, AREDS. And they, I think if you go to the store, you can only buy AREDS 2. Which is number two, which is the second study formulation.
Yeah, they didn't even. Usually they're like, holy shit, we got to rename this thing. We can't.
Let's distance ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's just named after the study, and everyone's got to have an acronym now.
Right.
I think the dangerous thing about these tests is that it's information without context.
Right.
Yeah.
And that can be very alarming depending on the perspective that you take, right? There was something on the news the other day about like some drug that doubles your risk of some terrible outcome, but from 1% to 2%.
Right.
And people are terrible at judging actual risks anyway. Mm-hmm. Like, just people in general. Even if you are sort of educated about what statistics mean, like, it can still feel really scary to say you have a 5% chance of something happening, but that's like one in every 20 people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you know, relatively speaking, not that high a risk, but maybe it feels really high.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes that
if
information,
you're talking about Alzheimer's, you know.
Yeah. And sometimes the information they're getting is not actionable. What if they're getting diagnosed, you know, for a disease that we don't have a treatment for?
This is why we won't do Huntington's without a whole process.
Yeah. And I actually, I feel really strongly about that, because I think that's really paternalistic of medicine to be like, oh, you know, we can't treat it, therefore, you know, you can't test your one-year-old for this disease. You have to wait till they're 18 and get their consent. And I think it's interesting, because there's a whole lot more to life than medicine. And we say, well, because we don't have a medical treatment for it, you can't test for it. I thought that was an interesting place to go with it.
As long as it applies to kids. You know, maybe 18's a little old, but like, I don't think I'd want to grow up knowing that I was going to have this like horrible disease in the future, and by my parents testing me and knowing that, I don't get a choice.
Yeah.
Right, but you didn't get a choice in who you were to begin with, and
No.
You didn't get a choice in whether they did it when you were a fetus. So you're allowed to do it when they're a fetus, but you're not allowed to do it once they're born.
Sure.
And so I just thought it was interesting.
But like, I don't care when I'm a fetus, because I'm not me. As far as I'm concerned, I don't exist as a fetus.
But what about as a six-month-old?
Do you closer. Exist? Not the me that's present today, obviously, but, like, closer.
Mm. It's hitting a moving target.
At the very least, I think you should be able to test for it as an adult. Like,
yeah. For sure.
I wonder where that policy came from, like, in the beginning. Did they, like, actually start out testing kids for it, and then it, like, appreciably decreased their quality of life and said, oh,
no
okay,
way.
Let's
There's
not
no
do
way
that
they did
anymore.
That.
No, I think it was a you know, a panel discussion conference standard that was set by the College of Genetic Whatevers or something like that.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It just reeks of
I love those meetings.
Just reeks of that.
Also, if they test me as a fetus, they just shouldn't tell me then.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing. Like, if they test you as a fetus, and then I guess they're deciding whether to keep the fetus or not, that's a whole different ethical discussion.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like adoption. Like, people have much more control over when and where they tell their children that they're adopted, but it can have maybe just as big an impact on their the direction of their lives. I don't know.
I'm going to join the American College of Genetic Whatevers.
I think actually, you know what? We ought to start that.
They don't sound like they have very.
It's a very reputable.
They don't sound like they have very, you know, big criteria.
ACGW. American College of Genetic Whatevers starts today. T-shirts available on the website.
I call to order our first meeting.
T-shirts will be available on the Shortcoat Podcast website.
Well, you heard it here first.
Yeah. Did you guys talk about, speaking of vitamins, circling back a little bit, did you guys talk about that new sepsis treatment thing that's been bouncing around? I feel like we should throw that out there.
Quickly,
that would be fascinating.
Quickly, because we have a very important thing to get to.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Mm. Oh, God, you're going to make us do the test.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. As long as I don't have to eat any more Marmite.
No.
Unless
you want to.
This guy, does anybody remember? Oh, Eastern Virginia Medical School,
Virginia
decided to try a new formula to treat sepsis for intensive care unit patients. And sepsis comes from like infection, widespread infection in your body and your bloodstream. And it was just like, it was vitamin C, steroids, and vitamin B. And
Marmite.
That's
it. I mean,
and he rubs Marmite all over them.
Intravenous Marmite.
Yeah,
yeah, and people seem to be getting a lot better very quickly. And there's still, you know, it's very new, and there haven't been like rigorous clinical trials yet. But you know, it looks promising.
That's one of those breakthrough ones that seemed really cool to me. Like,
it does seem cool.
You know, like, gosh, That's amazing.
Which is why people are skeptical. You know, well, yeah. Can't be. You know, I don't want to be too good to be true.
And well, they should be.
But also, it's just vitamins and steroids, so it's probably not going to hurt people. Which is, like, I think, why he could just try it.
Yeah. So standard. So steroids is the standard of care.
Right.
That's part of what you give everyone who has sepsis.
Because they decrease inflammation, and sepsis is infection, which is tons of inflammation everywhere.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it really just sets off the stress response. The whole sort of stress response hormone system in your body, mm-hmm. to compensate for the fact that the sepsis is kind of pushing it in the other way. So you're trying to balance it, yeah. Essentially. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's interesting. I would be curious to see how much of this is due to vitamin C, because vitamin C plays a lot of roles that we... vitamin C, one of the things vitamin C does is it ends up chelating iron.
Mm-hmm.
And vitamin C,
which bacteria love iron, by the way.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So there's that. There's also the fact that vitamin C, when it's in higher concentrations in the blood, has profound impacts on cellular metabolism, because it affects the free iron inside the cell. Mm-hmm. And so we've actually exploited that, and we've done studies in humans of high dose vitamin C in cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So as a chemotherapy adjunct.
Yeah, actually.
And
does that look good?
It's impressive.
Not by itself. Don't just take vitamin C and think your cancer's going
to
go away.
You can't eat it, because you can't get it up to the concentrations you need it to be effective.
Yeah.
Not a monotherapy.
So we go. I think you can get like millimolar. Or micromolar concentrations by oral consumption, and they take you up to like millimolar concentrations, mm-hmm. in the bloodstream by doing intravenously.
Doesn't sound like a lot more, but it is.
That sounds it's a factor of 1,000.
Yeah.
Thank you, professor.
Yes, and it's just like what Casey said. You know, it's the risks of it are so low. I mean, the only side effect that they've had appreciated is that, you know, when you infuse 15 grams of ascorbic acid salt into someone, it's 15 grams of salt. They get thirsty.
It's a lot.
But other than that, there appears to be no other negative impact, and it has definitely positively impacted the cancer therapeutics. I don't know to what extent, but it's really, really promising in animal models, and we're working on getting there in humans. Because anyway. basically what we all need is steroids and Red
all
Bull
day, every day.
Red Bull injected into our veins.
Right.
That's basically what they're doing.
By the way,
and Marmite.
Speaking of Red Bull and Marmite. Speaking of Red Bull, I look out into the courtyard from my office. The listeners don't know what this means, but we have our med school has like a little courtyard in the middle of it, surrounded by research buildings and
it's
all that.
It's very nice.
Yeah. It kind of hit me the other day that like I live in a different world now than when I was a kid, because I looked over and saw a Red Bull delivery truck driving up to school, and I was like,
yeah, it was it was actually like a tanker truck, wasn't it?
Refuel the tanks.
Yeah, there's the school with Red Bull. Just
yeah.
There's an underground tank.
Yeah,
20,000 gallons.
Just a little service that we provide our med students. don't drink Red Bull. You guys, I may not be officially a medical educator here at the Carver College of Medicine, but unofficially. Oh, yeah. I am a very unofficial medical educator. In fact, every so often I feel it's necessary. No, that it is my duty in the interests of your continued learning, test your knowledge. So it's time for a pop quiz. Today's topic, amazing health products you can get. All right.
Ooh.
So let's
start. I'm skeptical yet intrigued.
Well, I don't think you should be. I think when you hear the questions, you will be. You will be adopting these techniques and products for your own patients. All right.
What did this show just turn into? It sounds like an infomercial.
Well,
where's Oprah?
Now you can do this.
This is where you're going to use
every day.
This is where you're going to use your new Marmite-soaked brains.
Oh. Okay.
Every day.
In 2009, Beverly Hills plastic surgeon Nicholas Chugay created something that helps people struggling with their weight. It works by discouraging them from eating solid food, making it uncomfortable to do so. How does it work? A, a substance A substance named ingestinon causes nausea when the patient consumes foods high in carbohydrates. B, a mechanical device strapped to the patient's waist that pokes them in the belly and says, careful.
Oh my God, that's terrifying.
At set times between meals. A patch stitched to the tongue in an outpatient procedure that makes it painful to consume solid food. Or D, a patient sits in a dark room between meals, the darkness occasionally interrupted by flashing colored lights and loud noises, distracting the patient from feelings of hunger. Which of these?
How long do you have to do that?
Okay, obviously which not of these, D.
Which of these right, is the true Chugay invention?
I mean, he's a surgeon, so I'm going with, yeah, probably C. Yeah, it's I'm interventional and sounds very uncomfortable.
And it sounds like you could charge people a lot for it.
Yeah. And A is like disulfiram. Like, if people don't like the effects, they'll just stop taking it.
Yeah.
A is a true thing? I just made that shit up.
Oh, well, no. I mean, it's for alcohol. Not
there's
carbs.
Something to that effect.
What was B again?
B was the mechanical device that poked you.
Oh, yeah. That was.
I really like that.
I thought you were going to say a harness for the mouth to just, like, prevent the mouth from opening wide enough to take it.
With B, it's a product braces. You could sell, though, so you could have reach a wider market that way. Yeah. I don't know.
I think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
But then people can knock it off.
True. Yeah.
The answer, as the Marmite has clearly had an effect, woo, because the answer is the tongue patch. Since consuming solid foods is painful, the dieter has to resort to a restrictive 800-calorie diet, liquid diet, developed by Dr. Chugay. The patch can be removed at any time by snipping the sutures. It should be removed within a month or the tongue may start growing over the patch.
Ooh,
which,
that's not good.
This is such a bad idea.
According to the good Dr. Chugay, the diet can help a patient in reducing 30 pounds in 1 month. Chugay and his son, Paul Chugay.
And then promptly gaining it back.
Chugay and his son, Paul Chugay, published a study in the American Journal of Cosmetic Surgery that said 70% of their patients lost an average of 16 pounds and kept it off for 8 months. So, legit.
Okay.
All right.
Not legit.
Don't try this at home, kids.
It's got to be longer than a year.
The Marmite is clearly doing its job. Question two, this product, direct from Japan, naturally helps you lose weight by making your food unappetizing. What is this product? A, bad time food spray, which is guaranteed to make your meal look like something that fell out of a zombie's nose.
That sounds like a Japanese product name. Yeah. Super happy, fun, unhappy meal time.
Super unhappy, bad time food spray.
B, blue shade glasses, which makes your food a difficult to enjoy shade of blue. Fit swatches, a sticky back piece of foul-scented fabric worn on the upper lip at mealtime. Or D, a picture of White House aide Steve Bannon eating oysters off of Vladimir Putin's bare chest.
Let's go with that one.
That sounds like a Cards Against Humanity.
Which of these is the true product?
Okay, I vote B.
You seemed very confident. She was signaling.
Which one was B?
That was the blue shade glasses, which makes your food difficult to enjoy shade of blue.
So have any of you guys read, I think it was like Food Inc., like a book that came out a while ago about like the food production industry and all this business. So there was a chapter or like a couple pages in the book about how like they had actually tested different ways of lighting food up to make it more appetizing. Mm-hmm. And when they lit it up with blue light, it just made people nauseous. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I take it back. They didn't light up the food. They put food coloring into the food and made blue burgers. And people, like, even just the sight of a bright blue burger just made people sick, like vomiting all over the place.
Jesus, I think I have an idea for the next show.
I feel like C would work as well, though. The patch of really stinky whatever under your nose.
It could work. But
I like the blue glasses.
Which one are people more likely to do, though?
Blue glasses, probably.
Yeah, I agree.
Blue also, Marmite on the next show.
I thought you were going to say hot sauce, but maybe that's just because I don't like hot sauce.
Wow. I love hot sauce.
You put that on anything.
Maybe Japanese people don't like hot sauce.
Immediately unappetizing to me.
Guys, I think I have an idea for the next show that Casey's on.
No!
Blue hot sauce.
Blue hot sauce.
I ate your Marmite. I will run.
Blue hot sauce that smells bad.
So what have we decided? We've decided...
B. Consensus is B.
All right. Yes, you're correct.
Yeah, go Marmite.
The manufacturer Yumatai claims that they calm the excitation of the brain the wearer experiences when they see fattening food. Sounds totally science-y.
Well, think about it. Like, what are the only naturally blue foods that you can think of?
Blueberries.
Like, blueberries.
Blueberries. That's Smurfs. It.
They're delicious.
That is not a naturally occurring color.
Smurfs.
Food.
Smurfs.
Smurfs.
Yeah. Yeah, and blueberries are purple, really.
It's yeah.
True. You know, they're not really blue.
I'm colorblind.
It's really not. Blue is like a mold color.
Yeah, it's weird. Well, when you see blue or black, you run.
Blue is also the color of like not oxygenated blood and not really blue, but like, yeah. Things that are not going well. Seawater.
That's why it's
like
the saddest color.
Things you don't want to consume. Although, I guess crabs and shellfish.
Crabs?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, lots of shellfish kind of blue.
Blue crabs.
When you cook them, they turn red.
Blue lobsters, blue lobsters.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. When you boil them, they're... Oh, that sounds so sad.
It's all about redox chemistry, guys. Come on.
Yeah. All right. That was very good. So far, Marmite is really helping out. Let's see. According to several websites, so you know it's true, this wine...
I get all my information from the internet.
Yeah. From several websites.
This wine is a health tonic in Korea and China, a cure-all for diseases like asthma, hepatic diseases, and more. This is because it contains what? A, cricket blood. B, the liquid squeezed from panda thyroid glands. C, extracts from the root of the Benoit plant, or D, dead newborn mice.
So I have actually had a patient that was on like pig thyroid.
Oh.
And it's an older way of making thyroid medication that's like, I mean, it's more reliable than it used to be, but the concentrations vary a lot more, so it's not ideal. But,
I bet they use science to get that pig thyroid, though. This
they
is just
do.
Like,
they
you know, did. Squeezed as far as like...
Wring it out?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think crickets actually
thyroid.
Have... I don't think crickets have blood. They don't have... Do they have circulatory
lymph,
systems? Yeah.
They do. It's hemolymph. Yeah. It's really not distinct. I mean, it's just sort of all the junk at once.
Yeah. Okay. So not that one.
I think you're being far too scientific.
I forgot the other one.
Remember,
just to be honest at this point.
well, remember,
Marmite,
this is,
I can't help it.
Pandas are hard to get thyroids from.
That's true.
So
they're also an endangered species.
Yeah.
They're
bad. And China, China loves pandas.
But remember,
so it, yeah.
We talked about this, and the listeners were not privy, but we can talk about tiger penis soup.
No, John.
That's legit.
He found a way.
I mean, it's not legit.
What is the nutritional value of penis? I just don't.
That's a great. It is edible. It is edible.
It's edible, but what really is there to be gained?
I would be speaking way outside my authority if I pretended to know anything.
Obviously,
about,
everyone in the room is
about
you,
what it's supposed to treat.
I happen to know.
Can I tell you the
but
best
it is,
and most?
It is an ancient Chinese medicine.
The best and most sacrilegious story about penises that I've ever heard.
Yes.
There's a theory that so all primates except most primates except humans have penis bones, and you can occasionally have like a mutation where someone has a penis bone, but it's rare. And so there's this like theory that, you know how in the Bible in Genesis, like Adam created Eve from a rib. Well, we don't have less rib, like men don't have less ribs on one side, but you know what bone they're missing? Penis bone. So there's a theory to which I now subscribe because it's hilarious.
Is that why why condoms are called ribbed?
Yeah.
Get out.
I mean, not all condoms.
Now it is.
But some of them.
Do we have an answer?
The historically accurate ones.
Can we hear the answers again?
Yeah.
That was sidetracked.
We've got cricket blood, the liquid squeezed from panda thyroid glands, extracts from the root of the Benoit plant, or dead newborn mice.
I'm going to go with Benoit plant.
Sure.
They like herbal
Charlie
medicine.
Out.
That's a
sure.
Sorry to say that it's in fact dead newborn mice.
Oh,
wow.
Ew.
To make the mice, the wine.
Sorry, that sounded really judgmental and racist, but.
No, I don't care. Ew.
To make the wine, the mice can be no more than 72 hours old. They shouldn't have open eyes, and they must be hairless.
Oh.
Wow.
So.
Well, nobody wants hairy wine.
You guys
should
give them your leftover lab rats.
Nobody wants hairy wine that stares at them.
Oh.
So yeah,
I wonder why the eyes shouldn't be opened.
I just think that would be gross. You'd be
they're
like,
too old
oh,
at
I'm
that
take,
point, probably.
I don't know. Take a swig of this wine and
well,
they're
that's,
staring back
yeah.
at me.
How I mean, you... once their eyes have opened, that's when you know they have a soul.
And that's what I was thinking. Maybe there was a cultural significance to the eye thing.
They can see you, and that means like something about loss of innocence. Maybe.
How many mice did they need
the
for
picture,
this?
The picture like I saw, basically They're picture small. Picture a, you know, what, 750 milliliter wine bottle. And the bottom.
We're in America.
And the bottom is like.
It's almost one of those medium-sized Mountain Dew bottles.
Yeah, and the bottom is like one single layer of dead baby mice.
Oh, it comes in the bottle, yeah. So you have to like shake it up.
Oh, it's like the worm in tequila.
That is not good.
So this is I call trolling. This is nonsense. I think
someone find an actual Chinese person. Because
I'm pretty sure
if that's a thing.
I'm pretty sure the worm and the tequila thing is also just like a tricking the gringos.
Yeah. Well, we had to find some on a scavenger hunt, so it does actually.
Oh,
exist.
It exists.
It definitely exists.
But it's not a mark of something of any measure of quality.
Yeah. Mexicans don't really do this. Is what you're saying? They're like.
That is correct.
It's for the tourists.
Turns out tequila can be made and tequila and mezcal can be made very, very high quality, just like whiskey.
Without
worms.
And they do not put worms in it. That's correct.
But don't you get to eat the worm at the end? It's like a treat.
Yeah.
Like a crunchy
little
treat.
To each their own.
And you have to drink an entire bottle of tequila before you would possibly enjoy
of
that.
Guys, perfect. Works out well. Yep.
Guys,
no
I think
one
I
would do that.
I think I have an idea for our next show.
No.
Drink
ideas.
A whole bottle of tequila. That sounds like a fun show.
Or eat worms
in the med school.
Question number 4. Endorsed by Oprah, Skin Medica face creams are claimed by their manufacturer to revitalize the skin due to the action of hormones derived from a slab of what? A, human foreskin. B, hamster liver. C, giant slug meat. Or D, whale vomit.
Wow.
Those are all unappealing options.
Liver. I'm going to say the liver.
It's like the one that people are most likely to actually rub on their face.
People eat liver. What? It's
like
very
if you
nutritious.
Think about the type of people.
So Casey's going with human foreskin.
I kind of want to go. I kind of want to go with whale vomit.
Okay.
How do you collect whale vomit?
Well, you got
it. Maybe they don't call
that.
It. Maybe they don't call it.
You
vomit.
Tickle it.
Maybe they don't call it vomit.
Stick,
maybe they call
stick
it
your
like
finger
bile.
Down its throat.
Oh, maybe.
Or like whale. I feel like there's some word.
Ambergris.
For it. Ambergris. Yeah. Okay, yes. It's that. That is very rare and used to be in perfume. Actually, no. Wait, it's not that because I think that's illegal now.
No,
perfumes.
No.
I thought
it's not illegal.
I think it'll
just, there's
it.
There are no regulations on this industry. You just
you
put
okay.
it on there.
Well, then I'm going
up on shore or something, yes. And you sell it to the highest bidder. That's
then I'm true. Going with that.
Yeah, but that's more for perfume. It's not for cosmetic products. I think they use it to make perfume.
They do.
I know nothing
they
about
do,
this topic.
But
well,
like,
I feel way left
welcome
behind
to my world.
Yeah, they do use it in perfume. But like, don't you want your cosmetic thing to smell good?
Yeah, that's fair.
All right. Do we have a consensus?
I'll take their word for it. I don't
whale
know.
Vomit.
Whale vomit.
Whale vomit.
No, the answer is A, human foreskin. It is derived from foreskin fibroblasts. Fibroblasts.
Foreskin and fiberglass do not mix. Just FYI.
The new industrial standard.
Foreskin fibroblasts, cultivated in laboratories and used to grow additional skin cells. Skin Medica use only the growth hormones derived from the foreskin tissue. On a related note, though, in 2006, Vancouver resident Dr. Paul Tenari became the first Canadian man to have a healthcare-funded foreskin restoration. At the time, he said that taking into account the cost of the surgery and the retail value of a foreskin, a single male foreskin can be worth around $100,000. So,
no way.
Why did they just chop those off and then, like, what, throw them away? Like people should be able to keep those in case they need to sell them later.
Well, there were at the time there were protests at the time that Oprah and Skin Medica and all this kind of came, you know, was a thing. There were protests surrounding, you know, circumcision and, you know, what people call genital mutilation.
Which there probably should be because, I don't know, I think it's really weird.
I can't believe it's so expensive. I mean, if you're a female.
I mean, keep in mind, no one's probably paid anywhere near this. That's just his theory of what it could be worth.
That's true.
There's no way anyone paid $100,000.
He said it's, you know, it takes into account the cost of the surgery and the retail value.
So. Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay.
But so the foreskin's probably like $10. And
yeah, predominantly the surgery. Yeah.
But that means that you shouldn't. That means you shouldn't be paying to have your circumcisions. Yeah, that means you
should
be getting paid to have your circumcisions. And that's even scarier.
Yeah.
Maybe that's
selling
this,
selling
like,
your children's body parts.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Can't or, do their genetic testing.
Or my own if I'm in a tight spot, you know, like.
Well, if your parents weren't greedy bastards right. and sold it already.
Yeah, geez.
Jerks.
All right. Last question. I don't think, I think the effects of the Marmite are wearing off. But we'll see. Consuming the placenta is thought to have several health benefits, of which I can't think of one at the moment. Which of the following is not among the recipes contained in the Amazon Kindle book 25 Placenta Recipes, Easy and Delicious Recipes for Cooking with Placenta! Exclamation point. Available for $2.99 on Amazon.com. Not a sponsor.
Are you put the affiliate link on the
here
on the
page? Yes. Here are the recipes. Which one of these is what was my question?
Placenta.
Which
placenta.
One of the, get him the Marmite.
Which one of these is not among the recipes? A, placenta pate. B, placenta power punch. C, placenta loaf. Or D, Philly cheese placenta steak.
Where's the placenta paella?
I really, 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 really hope people are not making placenta pate.
I think it's I think it's going to have to be ground up. For it to be at all edible and for you not to throw up all over everything, it's going to have to be ground up.
People dig on organ meat. I mean, this is an organ. People dig on organ meat, you know, like...
Okay.
Do people dig on their own organ?
I was more sympathetic to this until I actually like smelled the smells of a live birth.
Yeah.
And now I'm like a little bit less understanding.
There's a hallway in our hospital, but like between the NICU and the mother baby unit, that I swear, there is a Glade. Plug it in, scented amniotic fluid, scented Glade plug-in in there, and like Casey said, not an appetizing smell, not at all.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Why? I can't compare that smell to anything else. I don't know.
All I have to say is why they designed this area carpeted. I'll never know.
On the walls, too. The walls are carpeted for extra nausea.
Retention, yeah.
And it's blue carpet, by the way.
Oh, no!
at least don't have an appetite, then.
Pregnant women are going to be throwing up anyway, so, like, why not?
Yeah.
God.
So, which one? Placenta pate, placenta power punch, loaf, or Philly,
it sounds
Philly
like
cheese
a smoothie.
Placenta steak?
No. The power punch, I mean, it's called power punch. That's like totally their marketing jam.
True.
Okay. I mean, that's got to be in there.
Right. It sounds like a great potluck dish, though, doesn't it?
Oh my God.
That person would never get invited
to
dinner.
I think the placenta loaf is a better thing to bring to the potluck there.
You got to wait.
Put some Marmite on it.
You wait until everyone's taken a bite to tell them.
I have a surprise for you guys.
Never
that's
invite.
Made of placenta. All right, let's have an answer here.
Pate.
Yeah, pate.
I don't know.
Nate doesn't like it. Break away from the group. He said no.
I don't know. I don't like any of the options. Can we go through it one more time, just so I can refresh here?
Placenta pate, placenta power punch, placenta loaf, and Philly cheese placenta steak.
And what are you doing with the placenta steak? Are you like slicing it into like meat,
like grilling it like meat in a pan, probably the way you would cook. Like,
okay, I guess I could see that. Beef, all right, I'll stick with you guys then. I don't have a better option.
Well, the answer is Philly cheese placenta steak. That is not.
No.
That's one that I just made up. The other ones are true. So.
We were supposed to pick the fake one?
I forgot. D is always the goofy one.
Yeah, we were picking the fake one, but we didn't think there'd be like a good way to prepare like the pad thai thing or
pate,
the meat.
I guess if you cook it.
Placenta pad thai, that would be good.
Yeah. I bet that's in there.
Yeah.
I bet placenta pad thai is in there.
Their shawarma was definitely in there. So.
For real?
Yeah.
How dare you? Do not insult my people like that.
In the foreword, author Robin Cook says that placentophagy is the act of eating the placenta of a newborn offspring. I'm not sure if Robin is a she or he, suggests that if you are planning to consume your placenta, you should notify your birthing healthcare professional to ensure that he or she will have whatever is needed on hand to properly handle the organ, and cautions that it should be examined to ensure that it is healthy and approved for consumption.
What?
Who's
certifying this?
Yeah, first of all, so, like, why wouldn't it be healthy? Like,
so if
sorry, it has shards of metal sticking out of it. You can't eat that.
If you have an infection, right?
Yeah.
So chorioamnionitis is an infection that occurs intrauterine. uterinely.
Yeah.
And
I think the word you're looking for is into your uterine exhaustively. Right.
Obviously.
Affide.
Right. Yes.
And can involve the placenta as well. Okay. And so that would be one you wouldn't want to eat.
Yeah.
If it's not complete, like inspecting it also to make sure that it's complete, is just also part of like making sure that the mom doesn't have some retained.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. But you know, she could eat the bit that came out. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, they have to go in and get the other bit. So
yeah.
By the way, this week the Journal of Scientific Reports published an article which, for the first time, described the caloric content of the human body. 150 pound adult contains 125,822.25 calories, or roughly 3,812 Weight Watchers points.
That's not so bad.
The work was done to help understand whether cannibalism occurs in the record of human existence due to ritualistic or nutritional reasons. So,
well, I don't.
I mean, yes. I feel like it depends on the situation. Yeah.
The skeletal muscle, by the way, 32,000 calories. So,
yeah, fat. You want fat, guys? Yeah. Come on. Yeah. I mean, fat has an energy density higher than gasoline.
That's right. Why you in a cartoon. Fat.
That's why I don't eat gasoline.
In a cartoon, it's always the fattest character that like turns into a hamburger, and then everybody chases them around. You know, when they're starving. Yeah. You guys know what I'm talking about?
Yep. Exactly. Okay. It's always the fat guy.
Always the fat guy.
Fat guy always dies first too. No, I wasn't talking about movies or cartoons. I mean, I was talking about the hospital.
Aww. Right.
Aww,
that's our show. Thank you, John, Casey, Aline, and Nathan for being my co-hosts today.
You are so welcome.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you, listeners, for making us a part of your week. We know you have other sounds you could focus your cochlea on, and we're glad that you chose our sounds. If you like what you heard today, please review us on iTunes. If you have a suggestion for something we could talk about, send it to theshortcoats@gmail.com or leave us a message at 347-SHORT-CT. And like our Facebook page, where every week I post shows, share thoughts, ask questions, and do other things like our Facebook Live shows occasionally. The show is made possible by a generous donation by Carver College Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our opening music is by Dr. Fox. And our closing music is by Argo Fox. Talk to you in 1 week.